Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools and beyond. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Marisa Walbert, and I'm hosting today's episode, which is being recorded here at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Shen Harmon. He is a rising sophomore at Stanford Online High School, and he will be interviewing Clifford Johnson. Clifford is a professor of physics at UC Santa Barbara, where he researches high-energy theory focusing on quantum gravity black holes and string theory. His recent work explores new connections between random matrix models and black holes. Beyond research, Johnson is dedicated to bringing science into mainstream culture as a source of wonder, conversation, and understanding. He advises major films, TV shows, and novels, including Avengers Endgame, Thor Ragnarok, Star Trek, Dark Matter, and Fantastic Four, helping shape characters, storylines, and the portrayal of science and scientists. His collaborations, including PBS's Nova and a global Doctor Who Museum exhibit, reach millions worldwide. Johnson also created The Dialogues, a graphic novel blending science and art, and founded a science filmmaking competition to inspire future scientists and storytellers. Take it away, Shen.
All right. Before we start, I'd just like to thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to interview you. First question I'd like to ask you is, what does a normal day of you look like? Do you just do physics all day, or are there other things you like to do besides physics?
Well, let me start by saying thank you for thinking of chatting with me, and it's a delight to be here. What does a typical day look like? There are different kinds of typical days. There are days where a lot of my attention is on research projects, and that can involve, if I ever get a full day of research, which sometimes, you wonder, we seem to get busier and busier, that can involve sitting at my desk calculating, really just with a pencil and paper and scribbling and mumbling things to myself and going down blind alleys and coming out, having the occasional flash of insight and delight, and or standing at a chalkboard and scribbling things, or having discussions with colleagues, bouncing ideas off each other, telling what's going on, that sort of thing, with your own research. And sometimes the act of telling can get you unstuck. So that can be a much enjoyable research day. Can be little bits of those sorts of things. Other days, which are also typical, can be ones involving maybe preparation for teaching. Also teaching, actually standing in a classroom and teaching students, answering questions, having students come by the office and ask me questions, things like that, and I can try and unpack things that maybe, require a bit more time. And a lot of the preparation for that can take a lot of time, and a lot of the just the grunge of trying to tell a good story about the science that one's trying to teach. So that takes a lot of effort as well, but yeah, it looks different from a research day.
Yeah, so, super cool. I totally understand what you mean by, the act of telling can get you unstuck. Like, I feel like me personally, when I work with other people and I'm just constantly shouting and yelling and talking about my ideas, they tend to come into fruition more often than not. So I totally understand what you mean by that. So I guess next I wanted to talk to you about your experience working on these, huge mainstream movies and TV shows and whatnot. What was it like? I mean, did you meet any of the actors? Did you meet any of the filming crew? What's that like?
Sometimes, depends upon the project. A lot of time it's talking with the filmmakers at whatever level. Sometimes it's screenwriters, sometimes it's production people of various kinds, maybe specialists in VFX, or even people who are maybe wondering what a real working physics environment might look like on screen, how they might want to realize that. So I might give advice, maybe sketch ideas for how a machine might look like, and they go off and maybe build it, which can be fun. But other times it's also sometimes meeting an actor and helping them get a sense of what it's like to be a scientist, right? Which, you know, first and foremost is just be a human being, but there are certain kinds of ways they might say things, they might pronounce things, they might, a certain affect you might have as someone who lives the kind of life that we do, does the kinds of things that I do, you know, maybe scribbling at the desk. What does that actually look like? Because it's mostly solitary, so no one sees it. So you want to explain it to someone who's maybe trying to have that as be part of a character and so forth. Other times it's just, you know, someone sends you something to look at. You know, we're in the middle of the movie and we're about to shoot this thing. What's supposed to be on the board? Because we didn't realize everything you gave us last time isn't relevant anymore because we've changed the plot or something. So can we have some new equations, please? I had that a lot recently, actually. And so it's all the aspects of filmmaking that you might imagine, but the act of trying to help people bring some science into it, either as part of the plot or sometimes just as decoration or sometimes, you know, in the characters, you spend a lot of time brainstorming, if you're lucky. Most times it's just about buzzwords. You know, someone gets in touch and says, we want this to sound cool with some sciencey terms. And, you know, depending upon how much time I have, I may or may not get involved in that, and that can be helpful too. But sometimes it's a deep dive, like in my most recent projects, I've been involved from the very beginning. So the science is in the DNA of the final thing, which can be great. It really feels then like a complete journey with the filmmakers to help them realize their vision.
Yeah, that's so cool.
That was the longest answer ever.
Just a little follow-up question. I don't know. I recently watched Iron Man, and I don't know. Do you think Tony Stark is an accurate representation of what a super rich billionaire scientist would do?
Well, when I sit and look around the room at all my other super rich scientist billionaire friends, I think actually the original Iron Man movie, what year was that now? 2008?
Yeah,
something like that. That, you know, which kicked off so much of what we're familiar with the MCU, but in particular, I think kicked off because it came about around the same time as something called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is an organization that the National Academies of Sciences started to help improve the communication between people wanting to tell stories in quote-unquote Hollywood and people who can help them include, help them find scientists. Marvel Studios did a really great job of taking advantage of that. Word got around, some of the key producers there working on many of the properties that eventually became the various films, you know, that, you know, we can call up people and we're not bothering the scientists. They're really quite keen to help us incorporate science. And so you'll see a lot of those films have called on different kinds of scientists at different, you know, different kinds of expertise in a way that I think really did help enrich the storytelling more than just being decoration. I think it really helped root the thing. So I don't, you know, people often use the term realistic or, you know, you're there to help get the science realistic, or there's another word people use. But I think that sets everybody up for failure. That's not really the point. It's there to inspire. It is there to represent and illuminate also some aspects of the science that it's reflecting from the real world. But, you know, it's it's the Marvel universe, so it's Marvel science, as I like to call it. So, you know, there are no magic flying hammers and so on and so forth. But there are key aspects that I think are great. And when they take our advice about things like show scientists collaborating, show problem solving. It's not just about people beating each other up with fancy powers. You can use your mind to solve problems, to improve the world. And mistakes get made. You know, Tony Stark is a great representation of that, right? There's a lot of misuse of the science, sometimes intending to be good, but it goes wrong. That is a good reflection of our world. It gets people thinking about what we're doing in our real world about with the science and engineering and how we can use and misuse it. And so if you illustrate those kinds of things, that can be really helpful for all of us to reflect on who we are and what we're doing in our own world. I love the fact that we also just see him improvising and experimenting, you know, when he's trapped in the cave and he's just got, you know, some materials around that he has to adapt. And you see, there's just these scenes where you see him, you know, hammering a piece of metal and trying to shape something new. And that's a wonderful representation of what we as scientists and engineers can do, create. Out of nothing, new things.
So now I kind of wanted to get into the thick of it, you know, kind of start asking you about your work more specifically in terms of physics, less about movies. So what are you interested in? What do you like to do within the field of physics?
Well, I'm very interested in to sort of connect to movies and comics. I'm interested in origin stories, right? You know, how did Spider-Man get his powers, right? How did our universe come to be, right? How did we come to be? Right. What are we made of, and why? Why are things the way they are? Mm-hmm. Are the basic questions. So at the level of physics, this comes down to, or part of it can come down to understanding things about the nature of the basic particles which things seem to be made of. But then you get to ask questions about, well, where are these particles? And, well, they're moving around. They're moving around in space. Time is going by. We learn from relativity that there's this whole physical dynamical thing called space-time that has its own shape and can change. The matter in it can change it. This is the heart of Einstein's general relativity, which taught us how gravity works. Mm-hmm. And then we realize that that has implications for the entire origin of the universe. But then you start going, well, yeah, but also the world is quantum mechanical. There's an inevitability to that. We learned a little over 100 years ago. Actually, arguably, some would say that this is the centenary of the beginning of the maturity of quantum mechanics.
Right.
Well, how does that all fit into the story?
Right.
And so this leads you fairly rapidly, as it did in the 20th century, it leads you fairly rapidly to realize that there's a big frontier that we don't understand even the basics of in some ways, which is what happens when you put quantum physics and space-time together.
Right.
And it becomes extremely clear that we need new understanding when you start thinking about things like black holes.
Right.
A long time ago, people didn't worry about that so much because black holes were maybe just sort of strange theoretical constructs that come out of the equations. But now we know for sure that you can observe them. We're watching the results of black holes colliding with each other and so forth in various experiments. And so we need to understand them fully quantum mechanically. And it also pertains to what happens at the very beginning of the universe. What's the quantum mechanical description of space-time then? So those are the sorts of things that interest me.
Cool. So from what I understand, one of the most accepted theories tying together quantum mechanics and relatively in general is string theory, right? And you've done quite a bit of work on string theory. And I don't know. I guess I'd like to ask how much math you use on a regular day-to-day basis, like,
All of it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was like, well, string theory is just a bunch of topology, right? Like, in the end, it's just topological objects, right?
I mean, there's more to it than that, but the topological aspect is important, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, I don't know. I'm more into math than physics. In fact, I think I'm going to major in math. So I was just kind of curious, you know, how much math, what math do you use the most?
Oh, now that. I'm not sure how you quantify it. There's probably another form of mathematics needed to quantify how much mathematics you use in any given area.
You can put it in scientific notation if that works.
At the end of the day, some may argue, push back against this, but certainly I think as a physicist and as a theoretical physicist, I think that the language of nature, if nature has a language at all, is the language of patterns. The science of patterns, if you like, is mathematics. So in some sense, the language of nature is mathematics. We don't necessarily sit around thinking about what kind of mathematics we're doing. We're very pragmatic as theoretical physicists. We're just looking for what works, because our goal is to understand and make sense of the patterns we see in nature. And so we'll grab for whatever toolbox we need. And sometimes that requires topology and differential geometry, number theory, of course, basic calculus and things like that, that latter being was developed in the context of physics, right?
Exactly.
As an attempt to understand nature. So sometimes, especially in string theory and related fields, the mathematics you need hasn't been invented yet. So the physicists end up inventing it, and then the mathematicians sort of grumpily
accept it into their field,
redo it properly, and really maybe refine it, and then it gets them excited, and then they give us back new tools based on the sort of rough things that we helped craft, and it goes back and forth. So there's wonderful dialogue between physics and mathematics in the service of understanding nature. And it's I don't know how to quantify it. It just depends upon the problem in hand. There's some mathematics there.
as I'd guess, there would be some mathematics.
Well, it's interesting, you see, because I think people don't realize this. People outside the field don't realize how important it is to our thinking, the way we think about things, the way we describe things, to the point where if you can't quantify it, you're not really done yet, to some extent, because that's the point, trying to, you know, put it all together in a working framework that's makes sense. So oftentimes I get email from people just out of the blue. Part of that typical day is dealing with the emails from somebody out there saying, I have a passing interest in physics, and I've been thinking about Einstein, and I realize now he's wrong, and here's why. And I have this framework which involves, you know, different kinds of fragrant cheeses that'll explain the whole universe. And all I need is for you to help me, you know, fill out the math bit, and then we're good. And, you know, you have to sort of go, well, actually, no, it's the wrong way around. we can all sit around and come up with fun scenarios for why the universe works based on, you know, analogies and pointing at that looks a bit like that thing, what have you. That's easy. The hard part is building a framework that really works. And that's, you know, that's why we do this.
Cool. Yeah. All right. I think one final question for you is, I've already asked you what your day looks like, but I kind of want to ask you about, like, how much progress do you make? Like, do you make, like, slow and steady progress? Or is it, like, every few years you just have, I know how to do it. And then you just make a ton of progress in one day. Like,
it's a mixture. None of my answers are just one or the other. It's a little bit of both. Sometimes you chip away on things. Sometimes you chip away. And another thing I try and emphasize with students and postdocs, other people that you know you're trying to mentor along the way, which is to realize that sometimes you're working on something that seems completely useless in terms of ideas, and in some ways nothing is wasted in science in terms of ideas, and that it might be that you're working on something at the wrong moment for the wrong reasons. But as long as you're doing a good process, whatever that process is in your field, it might be recyclable later on, and especially in a theoretical physics environment, where you're calculating. As long as you're not actually just doing wrong calculations, those calculations may end up being irrelevant for what you thought they were good for, but they may well end up being useful for something else.
Right.
And so sometimes there's a lot of incremental stuff in the wrong direction, or there's a lot of incremental stuff and you're not quite getting it. You haven't found the way in yet. And then but that's all preparation. That tedious incremental stuff is still good, because then there will be that eureka moment. And the eureka moment doesn't happen without the preparation.
Right.
You know, the movies just like to show the eureka moment. But I encourage filmmakers to also show that bit before, where you're making wrong turns and getting it wrong and so on and so forth. A lovely film that does that is The Martian, by the way, where you see him making mistakes as he's going along. And that's all part of the process of science. And then the eureka moment is, you know, can be really golden. Or sometimes you work on something else and you see some completely other bit of science. You know, go to seminars that aren't about what you work on, is what I tell people, because sometimes you find that other scientists are doing something for completely other reasons in a completely different field, for which you have the tools, and you sit and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, I think I know how to do something useful here. Go back to your notebooks and you find, yeah, you can really actually have something to say here. The hard part might be getting them to listen, but you know, sometimes the results will get them to listen. So you never know. Everything's useful sometimes when it comes to speculative thought.
When do you think you know you've kind of gone down the quote wrong or right path? Like, is there a certain moment when you realize, yeah, this isn't really what I need? And once you realize that, do you keep going after you've kind of done all these calculations? I mean,
So I think it's important to, well, I'm very old fashioned. I keep notebooks. I just have, you know, endless rows and rows and rows of identical notebooks. I try and remember to put dates on things. Maybe it's a bad idea for them to be identical, because then you're trying to find something. Don't know where it is, but eventually you find it. But I write things down a lot, and I try and keep things, and I try and record my thoughts as well. So I'm scribbling, and it really is a little bit of a cliche, you know, sort of I'm saying things to my future self as I write along, as I go along. And so you keep it. So it might be that you've realized this is not really going to be helpful, but you might finish the calculation anyway, and then, okay, that's the calculation. Not sure what this is good for, but certainly I see now that this thing leads to this thing. And that's just part, and now it's in your head, now it's just a thing, part of the landscape of stuff that's in your head that new ideas will bounce off at some point. And sometimes you just want to see it through, but then unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we have many other pressures, right? We have to get out, we only have a finite amount of time. Every few years, we have to just justify our existence to whoever our funders are, right? We have to write new grant applications. So at some point you have to go, okay, I need to just step aside from this and do something that, you know, will more readily give me some results I can wave and point to. Or I have to give a talk at this conference in, you know, a month, and I need to shape these other results for that. So I need to stop what I'm doing on this thing and work on that. So there's these other things that sometimes are annoying, that pull you out of the thing, but sometimes I think they can be helpful. Otherwise, you could just stay on that wrong track obsessively, as happens, for, you know, decades. And it's good to have the luxury to do that, to work on one thing for decades. And wonderful things have come of that. but you, it can also be that you miss opportunities to contribute to other sets of ideas as well. So it's good to somehow pull yourself away.
Yeah.
The key thing is you can come back to it, especially if you've done a good job of documenting what you've done in your scribblings.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Clifford and Shen, for your time.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information on our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on social media.